As she walked down the steps leading from Apple's new store in the terminal, Shelby Knox, the director of organizing for Change.org, said simultaneous visits are taking place in Sydney, London, San Francisco, Bangalore, and Washington, D.C. She says they want Apple to make an ethical iPhone 5, and she handed the petitions with 250,000 signatures to the store manager.
We're coming together as fans of Apple who buy their products to say, we want an ethical product. You're a leader in technology, and we want you to be a leader in making ethical products for us to use.
When asked if she would switch to another brand, she said there really wasn't another ethical choice. Most companies are using the same Chinese factories. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. For the past few years, banks have been reluctant to lend money to small businesses and startups. So, increasingly, entrepreneurs have been turning to angel investor groups to get their companies up and running. Aaron Toner of member station WUWM in Milwaukee has that story.
35 well-dressed men and women are sipping wine and chatting in the lounge of one of Milwaukee's oldest and most exclusive social clubs. A century ago, this is where the city's giants of beer and banking mixed and mingled. Now, every single person in this room is worth at least $1 million, and once a month, they pool their money to invest in high-tech, fast-growth startups.
Hi, good to see you.
Good to see you.
This is Kelly.
Hey.
As waiters in white shirts and black ties take drink orders, Kelly Fitzsimmons makes her way across the shiny red tile floor. Over 5 years, this group has given Fitzsimmons more than $1 million for her fourth startup company in Milwaukee.
H-A-R-Q-E-N-O-U after the Q.
Her company is called Harkin. It's a web-based service that records voice conversations and allows users to take notes, share photos or slides, and then quickly retrieve key passages once the conversation is over. Right now, it's used mainly for job interviews by staffing companies.
You know, we text, we email, we tweet. And yet, when a conversation is vital, we stop texting and we pick up the phone and we talk.
At least Fitzsimmons hopes that's what we do. She's asking this group of Milwaukee investors to open their checkbooks yet again. She says angels have become a lifeline for entrepreneurs who can't get a bank loan or don't have the cash to bootstrap a company on their own. This group called Silicon Pastures is one of more than 20 angel investor groups in Wisconsin, and several more are being formed. That's an awful lot of millionaires here in the Dairy State. You have to be one to join an angel group.
The benefit of being in a group is pretty amazing to me.
Tim Keene is the director of the Golden Angels, another Milwaukee investor group. He says groups spread the risk and allow investors to bet on ventures they may know nothing about.
We had a deal a couple of years ago that was advanced generator of hydroxyl radicals for purifying water. And the guy said that to me, and I thought, I wouldn't know a hydroxyl radical if it shook my hand.
But another member of the group did know about hydroxyl radicals and encouraged fellow investors to pour money into the company. Keene says the group genuinely cares about helping good local companies grow by providing guidance and networking in addition to cash. Keene says Golden Angels investments over 7 years have generated thousands of new jobs in Wisconsin.
All growth in this economy comes from startups. I mean, it comes from people forming new companies and new ideas and taking risks. You know, to me, that's the guts of the American experience.
Today, there are about 350 angel investment groups across the country, 50 of them formed after the recession started in 2008. After their latest meeting in Milwaukee, Silicon Pastures investors likely won't put their checkbooks away for long. In a few weeks, entrepreneurs in the field of telemedicine will pitch to the group, hoping for cash to turn their startups into profitable businesses. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Toner in Milwaukee.
Now, if you're not already out of bed, maybe this will help you.
Wake up! Wake up, wake up, wake up! Up you wake, up you wake, up you wake, up you wake! This is Mr. Senior Love Daddy, your voice...
Samuel Jackson in the movie Do the Right Thing with quite a wake-up call. Maybe Renee and I should try that. But if you still feel sluggish and drowsy after you're up, do not blame us because it could be the quality of your sleep. New technology devices are available now, all claiming to help improve your sleep and your health. Rich Jaroslawski has been reviewing them for Bloomberg News. He's a technology columnist there, and he talked with Renee about those technologies.
Welcome to the program, and I'm going to start by saying, are you like everybody else? I mean, do you have sleep problems?
I think I am. In my case, I can get to sleep, but I never get enough sleep. And I think millions of Americans feel the same way.
So let's talk about these new devices. What are they supposed to do? What magic are they supposed to deliver?
Well, they take advantage of all the technology that already surrounds us, whether it's our smartphones or our personal computers. And what they're trying to do is measure how well we sleep and how long we sleep. The idea being that if it's something that we can track, we can improve by adopting healthier habits.
I have a couple of these devices sitting here with me on the table. And one of them is called Sleep Tracker. And it looks like a big watch. It looks like almost an underwater watch. And what it promises to do is to help you wake up at the ideal moment in your sleep cycle.
Exactly. The idea is if you wake up from a deep sleep, you're going to feel groggy. So what you do with these devices is that you give them a time that you say, I want to wake up by 6:45, for example. And because they're monitoring your sleep cycles while you're asleep, they will look for a time in the window 15 minutes or 20 minutes before that set alarm time where you're in a light sleep phase where you are more likely to wake up refreshed.
Right. So you have to put a device, though, on your wrist. There's another one here you put on your forehead, sort of like a sweatband with something stuck to it on the front. Tell us about this one.
This is the Zio. And what you're seeing here, there's a device that's about the size of a money clip, and the sensor is in that. And it's attached to this headband that you put on, which makes you look pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, this one will keep your partner up all night.
Well, it certainly, I don't know that you want to look in the mirror when you're wearing this one. And you wear it over your forehead. So it's detecting things like the electrical impulses in your brain, your eye movements, and it's capturing all this data. And then it will wirelessly transmit it to your phone where there's a free app that Zio provides that will allow you to track of what kind of sleep, whether it's REM sleep, how much deep sleep you've had, how many times you awaken during the night. And all those things go into calculating the quality of your sleep. And the idea is if you can track it and quantify it, you can improve it.
Now, none of these technologies are very streamlined, and certainly none of them are invisible. What, though, might they tell us about what we might see down the road?
The really significant thing about these things is what they augur for the future. They are all part of a trend called connected health and another trend called wearable technology. So you can imagine when one of these things might be shrunk down to the size of a button on your pajamas that is wirelessly communicating with a mobile device that's plugged in next to the bed, providing you with much better data and much more data and allowing you to share that data wirelessly with a doctor or healthcare provider. So you can kind of see where this is all going. But the fact is we're right now at such an early, early stage that some of these things can be a little bit clunky. You really got to be dedicated if you're going to wear a headband to bed every night.
Rich Jaroslawski is technology columnist for Bloomberg News and a regular guest on our program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For sale, 160 acres of rolling hills in California that's perfect for a vineyard, a cattle ranch, or communication with outer space. From member station KAZU, Krista Almanzon has the story.
To understand how Silicon Valley businessman Jeffrey Bullis ended up owning the Jamesburg Earth Station, a former telecommunications center with a 10-story satellite dish, you have to think back to 2004. The real estate market was booming, and Bullis was visiting a friend in Carmel Valley on California's central coast, where homes can still sell for millions.
And I was like, oh, I'd like to retire out here. What's available? What's a nice piece of property? And back then, he's like, well, nothing really good. He says, but the air station's for sale. Why don't you go buy it?
So Bullis did, complete with a barn, small house, 21,000-square-foot bomb-proof building, and that enormous satellite dish. For decades, the James Berg Earth Station was a relay point to broadcast countless historical events. Tiananmen Square, the Vietnam War, and...
That's one small step for man.
The Apollo 11 moon landing.
One giant leap for mankind.
Fiber optics replaced the Earth Station's function, so it closed in 2002. When Bullis bought it, he had to clean out a lot of obsolete equipment. As he walks through one of the now cavernous gymnasium-sized rooms, he says this has been his party house.
It's a great basketball room, and we have it's a shooting range, archery room. Kids come out, they have fun. That's what it's all about now.
It would be the most unique sale I've ever made.
That's Bullis's real estate agent, Bert Aronson. The property is back on the market.
Hoping that somebody who wanted to have a grow grapes out there might also want to store the finished product in the building when they were finished.
As it turns out, the greatest interest in this property has been because of that satellite dish. NASA contractor Dennis Wingo is seriously looking at it. He's advising a team competing for the Google Lunar X Prize. That's a $20 million award for the first privately funded team to get a rover to travel on the moon.
We would control them from here. To me, that's way more fun than worrying about the past. As important as the past is, I kind of look forward towards the future.
At this point, Wingo hasn't made an offer, so the property is still on the market. Asking price for the dish, the bunker, and the land? $4.2 million. For NPR News, I'm Krista Almanzon in Carmel Valley.
This is NPR News.
A couple of hours ago, we recorded history with an engineer named Casey Hopkins from Portland, Oregon. In 15 seconds, in 10 seconds, you will be a millionaire.
Well,
Casey and I were furiously refreshing a website called Kickstarter, where more than 12,000 people went to give him their money, $1.4 million of it. At 3 this afternoon, the funding became official. Here you go.
Boom.
The best things in life are free.
You're good to go.
Pretty surreal.
Casey's the first person ever to collect $1 million from Kickstarter. It's a website that helps entrepreneurs fund their projects with help from donors. And for Casey, it all started when he got an idea to build a new, better iPhone dock, a little charger stand, because he didn't like any of the ones he found in the store.
They're these little plastic pucks, and they don't work if you have a case on your phone. And they're so lightweight that when you go to grab it, the whole thing comes with it.
So Casey designed his own, one made of solid aircraft aluminum, and it doesn't move around when you take your iPhone out of it. He calls it the Elevation Dock, and he put his appeal on the Kickstarter site back in December.
Then it just exploded across the internet. We hit that $75,000 goal in 8 hours. In 24 hours, we had $168,000 in pre-orders.
People want this thing. Casey's received orders from retailers all over the world, Taiwan, South Korea, Australia. He's also promised an elevation dock to every person who contributed $59 to the project. And everyone else, well, they can buy one for about $90, but they'll have to wait until later this year. Well, Casey, I'm going to let you go because you don't have a whole lot of time. You got to make 15,000 docks, man.
That's right. Nose to the grindstone.
That's Casey Hopkins. He's the founder of Elevation Lab and the creator of the Elevation Dock. His idea raised $1.5 million on Kickstarter. Casey, thanks so much.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Talking electronics, such as computers and iPhone apps, have dramatically changed day-to-day life for people who are blind. But some advocates for the visually impaired are concerned that good old-fashioned reading is falling by the wayside. More from Colorado Public Radio's Megan Verlee.
Like a lot of iPhone users, Rolando Terrazas can seem glued to that shiny chunk of glass and metal, and mostly for the same reasons everyone's hooked. Email, text messages, finding a decent coffee shop. But Terrazas' phone does a bit more.
So, we're going to go to Money Reader right here. Double tap.
Terrazas waves a bill under the phone's camera.
Let's see what this one is.
$20.
Having an app to tell money apart can be a big help for blind people like Terrazas. It means they don't have to just trust clerks to give them correct change. Terrazas is 19, and his daily life is full of useful technology like this. But it has a downside.
All through elementary school, I used Braille. But when I got a laptop, I switched over, and I went away from Braille. If you don't use it, you lose it. And that's what happened to me.
He uses software that reads out loud what's on his computer screen. These days, Terrazas is slowly relearning Braille as a student at the Colorado Center for the Blind, south of Denver. It's late afternoon at the center, and one of the instructors is logging in using a Braille typewriter in the lobby.
What time is it?
The center puts a lot of effort into convincing students they still need Braille to be independent and employable. Director Julie Deedon says that technology is making the 200-year-old writing system more accessible than ever. Deedon shows off an electronic reader about the size of a paperback.
When I was reading Tuesdays with Maury, and so I can go right into the book.
Instead of having to lug around massive volumes of printed Braille, she just sweeps her fingers over little plastic nubs that rise and lower with each line of text. Deedon worries smartphones and such mask a serious problem, Braille illiteracy.
People will let it go, and they'll say, well, you know, they're not really illiterate. They just don't really use Braille or print very much, but that's just because they're blind. I think that it's kind of an out, and technically, they really are mostly illiterate.
Blind people choosing not to learn Braille is only one part of the equation. Chris Danielson with the National Federation of the Blind says his group is increasingly butting heads with school districts trying to get out of their federal obligation to provide a Braille teacher.
They will tend to say, well, we have screen magnification software, we have all these tools available, and in light of that, we don't think it's necessary for a blind person to be taught Braille.
The Federation estimates that today only 1 in 10 blind people can read Braille. That's down dramatically from the early part of last century. Jackie Olette never thought she'd learn Braille, since she lost her sight as an adult after an operation. Standing in a cafe in a Denver suburb, Olette says learning to read again was the last thing on her mind.
When am I ever going to use Braille? I'm never going to sit down and read a novel in Braille. You know, I'd rather download an audiobook from iTunes, you know?
But last year, Olette was getting her yoga instructor certification. And during those classes, it became apparent that having a mechanical voice reading off her teaching notes didn't make for a very soothing yoga experience.
So I realized, you know, there is a use for Braille, and I think everybody uses Braille in their own way. You know, I think that everybody finds what they need to use Braille for.
Advocates for Braille are hoping blind people like Olette will continue to find enough reasons to keep their tactile system of writing alive, even amidst the growing chorus of computer voices. For NPR News, I'm Megan Verlee in Denver.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at carbonite.com. This is NPR News.